At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
You're listening to the Chasing Tales Outdoor Podcast, where when you can't be in the outdoors, we bring it to you. Welcome back to another episode of the Chasing Tales Outdoor Podcast, where our only goal is to inspire, motivate, and help you get in the outdoors to do a little bit more. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Walt. His name is Chase. We're a couple of Florida boys who just enjoy being outside, having a good time, and today we're talking about deer hunting. We're making the transition from turkey into deer, and I know that's something that a lot of you guys have been waiting on, and here comes that transition. We're going to start getting going again. We're going to dust the bows off. We're going to dust the trail cameras off, and it's time to start getting prepared, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, dude, Chase, man, I feel like I don't talk to you on the phone near as much as I did when I had an office and I had that little commute. So what's good in your world, man?
Well, man, right now I am just getting things kind of shored up. I graduated college, finally.
Congratulations, sir.
About a week ago. So completely done with that. And I am getting things ready to start the Yakking for Bass Challenge. So that's about it right now.
Heck yeah, dude. I'm really excited. This is the time of season where it used to be that time just was a standstill and you were just counting down the dog days of summer, but the Yakking for Bass Challenge eats up a month of that. By the time the Yakking for Bass Challenge is over, you start feeling really good about putting trail cameras out to get, you know, velvet antlers and maybe I should tweak my setup a little bit, so you spend your afternoon shooting your bow. I feel like if you're really a good outdoorsman taking advantage of everything you've got to offer, you should be busy the whole time, and deer season should just like show up, like it should just suddenly drop on you.
Yeah. All you got to do is just go out into the woods at that point.
That's right.
I agree. But right now, my focus is going to be the Yakking for Bass Challenge for the next month. I'm diving full bore into that, and once that's over, I'll start getting into my scouting and getting everything ready for deer season.
Yeah, man.
I've got a win for the creator for 3 years in a row, so it's gonna take a lot of fishing for me to even be able to come close to that goal. So I'm diving full bore in. I'm just letting everybody know. If I have to out on the water every day of the 30, then I'll be out there every day of the 30.
I love this. Okay, we'll just talk about this. We'll get to some other things later. My favorite thing about the Yakking for Bass Challenge is so much crap talking is done. If you haven't already, go and find the Yakking for Bass. There's no G on Yakking. Yakking for Bass Tournament Group. It's on Facebook. It's an open group. You guys can go in there and see some of the smack talking. In this case, I'm going to highlight Austin Schweitzer's Photoshop skills. I mean, the dude's just an animal. It's a great time over there. A lot of side bets and side wagers are posted, and it's just so much fun because it's all in good faith. You know, it's you know, no one's really out to get anybody except for Chuck. And so it's just a good time, man. It feeds that competitive side of me.
Yeah. It definitely does that. And I enjoy fishing with a lot of the guys that we're competing against. It's fun getting to go out with them. And I just enjoy the whole 30-day grind because it's one of those cool things where it's just not like a weekend where you go out and you fish and then somebody gets lucky and wins it all or whatever because they had one good day of fishing. It's puts you to the test. I'm looking forward to it. And it's coming up in, what, 5 days, 6 days? Six days we'll be on the water?
By the time this episode drops, it'll be 4 days until we'll be on the water.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's close, man. I'm on the same path as you. Everybody knows by now I've got a kid on the way. And so at any point in time,
in the next 2 weeks, I could basically just go MIA for this tournament. And so I'm getting all my honeydews done. I'm getting the grass mowed, the little projects done, because I'm in a similar boat to you in the sense that the moment this tournament kicks off, I'm going to spend every waking moment my wife will give me. Morning, evening, middle of the night, lunch break, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to be out there trying to make it happen because I man, my tournament's coming to an end very soon.
Yep. You got to strike out there early. Got to put some numbers on the board early.
So I want to touch on a couple things real quick. We've gotten some questions about the Yakking for Bass Challenge. I failed to post a link like I said I would in the last podcast episode's show notes, but we will rectify that this situation. Tourney X is an app you can go to. We've gotten a lot of questions on how to find it. If you just type in Yakking, Y-A-K-K-I-N, apostrophe, it pops up. Don't put anything else in there. Tourney X is a little fickle for some reason about populating tournaments. I don't know why that is the case, but it is. So if you're looking for it on Tourney X and you're not, you know, clicking on the show notes, which is the easy way for you to do this, if you're on your phone, click the show notes or scroll down in the show notes, click the link that we're going to include. It'll take you right to the tournament or go to the Yakking group that I told you about. And there's a pinned post in there where you can sign up for this year's tournament. They're just, for some reason, people haven't been able to find it quite as easily. So I've been sending people individual links. And if that would help you, shoot me a message. If you're, you know, hey, can't find the link, I'll just send it to you. I got it saved on my phone. Makes it real easy. Sorry about that. I don't know why it won't populate when you do a search for some people. The other thing is we've gotten a lot of questions about night fishing. Two different people this week have reached out about whether or not you can night fish in this tournament. Absolutely, you can. Here's the deal, guys. From a kayak without a gas-powered motor, from a paddle sport, from an inner tube, put it on a board, take a photo, submit it. No live bait. If you keep those rules in mind, you're pretty much square. Have I missed any of the really big ones, Chase?
No. I mean, that's really all you need to know for this tournament. I mean, it's 30 days long. There's no time constrictions of when you can fish, like 8 o'clock in the morning until 6 p.m. every day. That's just right. The entire time once the clock starts until it ends.
Absolutely. I think the only real significant change that we have this year, which we just kind of settled in group, is we're going to leave registration for this open the entirety of the tournament. It's a fundraising event. It's a low stakes event. It's $25. And we found that a lot of times last year, as we were dropping content about the Yakking Challenge, people were like, hey, how do I register? And it was too late because registration was closed. So we're going to leave it open the entire time. If you have friends or family who want to donate to takemefishing.org, that is the primary motive of this. We are just trying to raise attention for takemefishing.org. And also, we actually have a new corporate sponsor for this event. It's Country Boy Baits. He's a Florida dude. Jesse is a great guy. Go to his website. Show him some love. He's got some really awesome stuff. If you fish Florida-style lakes, heavy vegetation, stuff like that, he really has honed in on what works well for him. And his prices are fair. His work is awesome. Adam Glass speaks very highly of him. And just huge shout out to Country Boy Baits and Jesse for partnering with us this year. We got some other things in the works, but we're going to announce it as it comes.
Isn't he also fishing in the challenge?
He is.
So,
yep.
Yeah, that'll be great. I'm excited.
Well, before we get to this episode, let's go ahead and crank out a couple business items. First, we got to thank the people over at Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding source that allows us to do more with this. We can travel more. We can do more in-person podcasts. We get to travel together to meet up, Chase and I do, to hunt and do videos together. And that's, you know, that the level of those videos are increasing because of it. And we just want to say thanks for everything that you guys do. Chase, you kind of picked out this quarterly Q2's giveaway package. Why don't you tell everybody what they're getting this year or this quarter?
Yeah. We figured that the people are wanting to be this time of year getting out scouting. Eventually, pretty soon, they'll be putting out cameras trying to catch all those deer in velvet. So the package for this quarter, we have a Browning cellular trail camera, and we're going to bundle that with four of the Simmons trail cameras that you did a YouTube video on. Yep. We figured a five trail camera bundle there should be able to get anybody who doesn't have cameras started, or somebody who's wanting to break down a new piece of public or private land. That would be like kind of like the perfect starter kit for somebody to be able to be on the deer 365 days a year.
Absolutely. I mean, non-cellular and cellular, that is something when we spoke to Spy Point about, it was a real important piece how both of those play an important role in how you approach things, both public and private. So I'm excited. I happen to think that the best non-cellular cameras are those Simmons. For the amount of them that you can get for the money, they take great photos. I mean, if you're a public land dude, if someone steals one, it doesn't hurt you financially. You don't like it, obviously, but it doesn't hurt you. So that's exciting. So go to patreon.com. Again, that's in the show notes as well. If you guys want to scroll down, if you sign up, you can get free stickers, you can get free hats, you can get added to our Marco Polo community, which is about 30 people strong now at this point, and they all seem to have something really unique to bring to the table. And so it's a great place to meet up with people, bounce ideas off of them, and learn as we all learn together. So it's a great thing to have. Also, we need to thank a couple other people. First, Scree Gear. If you are interested in technical gear that will bring your level of comfort in the woods to the next level and keep you concealed, ScreeGear.com. They make fantastic hunting gear, technical hunting clothing. It is out of this world, hands down, my favorite to date. Chasing Tales 15 will save you 15% off any regular price merchandise, and don't forget to check out their bundles. Tethered Nation, you guys know about the Tethered One Stick. The Tethered One Stick is amazing. It was the highlight of the teach and train here in Tallahassee a few weeks back. It is absurdly light. It is absurdly compact, and you're going to love it. Check them out, tetherednation.com. We've been on board with them since day one, and couldn't be happier. I mean, they are fantastic people. Greg, Ernie, all of them, fantastic folks, wonderful people. Reach out if you got any questions. We'll talk saddle hunting with you all day long. And last but not least, Spartan Forge. This one's right on point with today's podcast episode, because Spartan Forge is all about creating patterns that we can replicate and make predictions for. It's an AI software that takes data points from live deer, puts them into a pile, makes predictions based on pressure, weather, you know, biological forces, takes it all and puts it into one learning device, which is going to be on an app very, very soon. We're going to have Bill on the show very soon, and we're going to kind of talk about the postseason applications for Spartan Forge. And Chase, Spartan Forge was spot on the money last year in its beta form for both you and I, and I think Brett said that it worked really well. And as a segue into this episode, man, why don't you kind of tell everybody about what's going on there?
Yeah. For this week's episode, we got Brett Mashburn on the podcast. He's a member, a Patreon member of ours, really big into the Marco Polo. He's constantly sharing his postseason scouting and everything else on the Marco Polo group. We had him on the podcast during the Tethered Teach and Train, where we did the group podcast. You and I discussed that we'd like to get him on the podcast as more of a kind of like solo podcast for him, so he could dive deeper into what he's doing on public land in Alabama. And he didn't disappoint during this podcast. I got to do the podcast because you weren't able to make it. So that was a little bit different for me, but I think that we covered a lot of different points that maybe people who are out there on public land that might be struggling. Because he kind of went over, basically started from day one when he started getting into public land and the progression he's made to now, which he's a big buck killer now. So it sounds like he's figured out a lot of things, and he shares kind of his journey.
Yeah, Brett is an awesome dude. I enjoy his contributions to the group because he is such a constant presence in the deer woods. He's very transparent with what he's doing. He takes the time while he's out there to show us in the Marco Polo group, okay, here's the transition area, here's the transition area within it, and here's the trail, and do you see why the deer are coming down here? Look how churned up it is. Here's the photos that I've got. I mean, he dang near contributes like he's an outdoor writer to the podcast, which is amazing. He does it in video format. It's very, you know, he answers questions about it. He's always encouraging. I am thrilled to listen to this one. I'm sorry I didn't make it, but I am thrilled to listen to this one because I think it is going to be one that anybody who wants to hustle to make public land work, I honestly think this will probably translate pretty well to private land as well. This is going to be one you're not going to want to forget. It might be one that you probably want to listen to more than once, because I guarantee you there's nuggets in there that you're going to pull out over and over again.
Yeah. He touched on a lot of different things. One of the better parts was his postseason scouting, which I think everybody will get something out of, was how his whole approach to postseason scouting, the amount of hours he puts in postseason scouting and trying to figure out deer, utilizing his trail cameras during that time. He talked about how the saddle changed the game for him, and that he was able to hunt areas that he had never been able to hunt before. So a lot of good information was in there. And he, like I said, he really harped on that postseason scouting and how he enjoyed that so much. And he thought that that was one of the biggest differences in his success as a deer hunter.
Yeah, for sure. I can't wait to listen to this one. I just noted that I left something off of my intro, guys. So if this episode gets you jonesing for deer season, if it gets you jonesing to put some trail cameras out, we mentioned Spartan Fords. I forgot to tell you guys that we have a promo code, Chasing Tails, just those two words, all lower caps or all uppercase, Chasing Tails, T-A-L-E-S, will lock in for life for $20, no matter all the upgrades that come down the pipe, $20 a year for life over at Spartan Fords. Those two things, both this episode and Spartan Forge, I guarantee you go in tandem with each other. I just didn't want you guys to miss out on that money saving opportunity. I think most of our patrons have signed up and locked in that $20 price, including Brett.
Yeah. Yep. I'm pretty sure just from listening to them on the Markipelago group.
So there you go. So Chase, I'm not going to babble on because I haven't even listened to this episode. I want to listen to it. So I'm going to stop, let the episode get going, and I can't wait to listen.
Let's do it.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Chasing Tails Outdoor Podcast. Riding solo, Walter is not going to be able to make this episode. I am joined by Mr. Brett Mashburn. Most of you who listen to the podcast heard him briefly on our roundtable discussion from the Tethered Teach and Train. Walter and I had both discussed after that we really wanted to get Brett back on the podcast to dive in more. Brett's had a lot of success on Alabama public land. So how are you doing tonight, Brett?
I'm doing good, Chase.
Doing good. Yeah, we get to basically we're in touch with you all the time since you're one of our Patreon members and always on Marco Polo, which is good. I'm glad that we're actually having somebody on that's from the Patreon group. You contribute a lot on that Patreon group. I don't think on our last podcast you really got a chance to kind of tell everybody who you are. So why don't you give everybody kind of the drone view of Brett Mashburn?
Yeah, so I'm Brett Mashburn. I'm from South Alabama. I guess I basically started hunting as around 12 or 13 years old. Basically, I just got into hunting and just hunting private leases. Well, my dad, probably like most people did, and I hunted private leases probably up until the age of around 19. You know, just as when I started out hunting, I started out just hunting stands that were already kind of in place and ladder stands mainly, and hunting places my dad set up for me, not actually knowing the reason why or the thought process behind the stand placement or exactly why I was there, as he liked to set up a lot of stuff in the woods and different places. And I would probably say I hunted like that for a long time. And probably by the age of 16, I was hooked on deer hunting. And I got into bow hunting, which gave me a month extra of deer season. So I was all about that. So that's kind of how I got started into bow hunting, was around 16, just for a longer deer season, really. I'd say the last 2 years or so of hunting private leases, my dad got in a lease and just outside of Selma. And I don't know if y'all know about that region, but it is loaded with deer. I mean, just the deer numbers are crazy. And this place is full of shooting houses and ladder stands. And they had like this big mat with pins all over it, and you would basically pick out which stand you want, and just hung your little pin on it. And they kind of did a thing where you went in as a group, say that morning, and everybody agreed to get out at like 9:30 and meet up. But the only thing about this was they didn't allow anybody to walk in the woods. They didn't allow anybody to take a climber and actually go find a place to hunt. They made you hunt stands that were already in place, like on food plots and maybe on a road or so. That was all fine and dandy when, especially for kids, because you had tons of opportunity to kill deer and stuff like that. But I believe there was a lot of politics involved with it. and also in other leases, there just seemed to be a lot of politics here and there. And kind of some stuff happened, and I think we my dad got out of that lease, and after that, my dad just didn't get back in the lease again. And I don't know if it was something to do with money or politics or, you know, wasn't allowing him to do his style of hunting, which I know his style of hunting, he taught me at an early age, that to walk on the edge of your feet, he liked to do a lot of slip hunting. He would walk, I'd say, 40, 50 yards, stand by a tree, and just sit there or stand there for 20 or 30 minutes and keep moving on. And he did that around like swamps and like transition lines and stuff like that. You know, looking back now, I know that, but at the time I didn't. So really by the age of 19, I was 100% locked into deer hunting. Just, I was all out on the deer hunting. Here I am with nowhere to deer hunt. I have a few friends of mine that, you know, I was talking to about this, and they had just previously started hunting public land. And they were like, man, you should come with me. You should come out here and go hunting with us. So I was invited by them and ended up going hunting public land with a few of my buddies. And that's really where the public land all began for me. But yeah, so I started hunting public land, I'd say the first year or so. Was pretty tough. I did see deer, and I don't think I killed a deer that first year. And I did shoot a deer, but didn't find it with my bow. And I was still pretty new into bow hunting. You know, like I said, I started bow hunting at 16. This was maybe the age of 19 or 20 now, and I hadn't killed very many deer with my bow, so I was still getting into that. And having to learn actually how to hunt, because there wasn't just stands out there for me to go to. I had to actually figure it out for myself.
Right.
So that's where reality hit. I didn't realize how sheltered I was from hunting private land. You know, looking back now of all the years I've hunted public, I didn't realize how much strategy, how much work, how much thought and everything went into just simply deer hunting, not to mention hunting bucks, which seems to be a totally different creature than hunting, you know, does.
Right. Now
hunting deer in general. That's basically my story starting out into public or up to public.
Now, did you have a mentor or anybody that you talked to about hunting public land when you first got into it?
No, I didn't. I just had, like I said, I had two or three buddies that were hunting, and we were just all just out there gung-ho doing our thing. Just we were getting after it, man, but, you know, we wasn't really successful. We did kill some deer. Now, don't get me wrong, just sheer – I think the time we spent in the woods, I mean, we went hunting every weekend. We hunted hard. We wasn't scared to walk. We would walk and scout. As soon as we got out of the tree, we'd go scouting. And we'd scout all day until it was time to get in and hunt that afternoon.
I'm assuming it was kind of a, like you mentioned, it was a culture shock when you go from hunting private and pretty much everything's laid out for you. And did you ever really question, I mean, how much questioning of that did you really do when you were hunting on the private land? Because I know the transition had to be hard once you made it to strictly hunting public land. So when you were, I mean, I understand that you were younger. It sounds like you were a teenager when you were doing all that. But was there anything ever in like the back of your mind saying, I wonder if I tried this or if I tried that, did something different, I would have more success? Were you having any success killing any big bucks or anything like that on the private spot?
Yes, I have killed bucks. I wouldn't say really big bucks. I would say, you know, some 2.5-year-old and 3.5-year-old bucks, you know, through the first years of hunting on private land. And like one of the culture shocks being that, like a lot of these WMAs and places I was trying to hunt, didn't really have like these food plots and nice roads. You actually had to get out and walk. You had to put in the footwork and figure it out yourself. It wasn't just a food plot and a stand sitting out there. So he had to actually go out there and look for deer sign and figure out where the deer were, which was totally just, that was just something I wasn't used to at all.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely understandable. I mean, I started hunting on private land. It was kind of the same thing. I mean, my father-in-law, he was a big private land hunter, and he kind of gave me some direction. He had the same thing, kind of like had his set stands and everything that he hunted. And I think they were just good kind of like on a year in, year out basis, like traditional areas that were pretty good. And he kind of set me up in some areas and kind of told me a little bit of what to look for. But there, like you mentioned, there wasn't a whole lot of like scouting or going out and finding deer sign or anything. I mean, in Florida, you could use feeders and baiting and food plots and all that. So it was all really kind of focused around that. And I probably did that for maybe a couple of years. And when I wasn't really having the success I wanted, that's when I started kind of thinking about, okay, having a different approach, like feet on the ground, scouting, looking for deer signs, becoming mobile. How was that transition of just becoming a mobile hunter once you hit public land? Or were you just setting up stands out there and you were going to hunt those stands a lot?
I've always been, since day one, a public mobile. You know, I hunted in a climber for several years, you know, until the past 2 years. But so, yeah, I used a mobile climbing stand. And I think probably the first few years of hunting public seemed to be I'd find these pretty places, woods and hardwoods, and would walk through them and like try to find trails or some kind of tracks and stuff like that, some kind of deer sign, and try to hunt that way. And after a few years, me and my buddy started realizing places that we were seeing deer, we found a lot of deer scat, and we started focusing in on every place that we found deer scat in, that we would go in there and hunt them. And I would say our deer sightings went up a lot when we started doing that, because we were actually finding the hot sign where they were feeding at that time.
Right.
And when we started doing that, that was our first, you know, step into seeing more deer at the time early on, and started, you know, giving us ideas of what to focus on.
Right. So just finding that, I guess, deer poop, scat, whatever you want to call it, was one of kind of your major breakthroughs there, from going to seeing deer to seeing a whole lot more deer.
Yeah. I mean, that's just how sheltered I was in the beginning.
Right. So, oh, yeah, I understand. I understand where you're coming from. And
I felt like I had to start from scratch.
When you started finding that, and did you get any other, like, ideas? Okay, it's like, okay, I'm finding more deer. Were you finding more bucks, more does, finding both, finding more mature deer? I mean, or did you have to start kind of where you found that and started dialing in the area more to kind of figure out, okay, where are these deer using, and how are they traveling back and forth to these areas?
Yeah, so mainly what I was finding was just deer in general, like does, maybe some young bucks, you know, just some little forkhorn bucks and stuff like that. Nothing major. I'd maybe see a decent buck, like a 2.5-year-old or something, but it was mainly just does. Doing this way. And also, when I first started, I felt like I was trying to hunt the whole WMA. We would go over every place and walk and just try to find what we thought at the time was like the best sign and best looking places, and not thinking about our access, not thinking about when, not thinking about what time of the year it was. I mean, just so many things have just did not know back then that I look at now. It's like, wow, I can look back now on some of my experiences I had with mature bucks back then, and I realize now why I seen them there, you know, back then in these certain places.
Right.
That I had no clue. Like, so when I did get on a big buck on public land early on, you know, probably I'd say 4 or 5 years into it. So within the first, after year four, probably through year eight or so, I ended up shooting 2 mature bucks that would be on my wall right now had I found them. Right. But two mature bucks, and looking back on that, I couldn't have told you why I had an encounter with them deer at that time. But knowing what I know now, I can tell you exactly why. One of them was I caught on a transition where there was 4 different habitats all coming together in this one spot, and it was right next to private land that had big ag fields. So I caught one there, and then this other one was basically a big pinch point where there's 2 swamps that come together, and where it necks down to the smallest point. It seemed like all the deer crossing this area, they come from like 5 different directions, basically coming from like coming in and out of swamps. It was just a big, you know, just funnel basically. And that's another place I had an encounter with a really big buck that I was on for probably a couple of weeks before I shot him and didn't end up recovering after I ran out in the swamp and I couldn't track him no more.
Right. Yeah, I think that is something that I also didn't do early on myself, is when I would have like a big buck encounter, I would never ask the question to myself why. I was always just maybe in the back of my head just going, oh, well, maybe it was just lucky, right place, right time. And I didn't really consider all of the factors kind of like you were just mentioning, like, oh, there, if it's a big buck, there's a reason, and you got to ask your question. And I think a lot of the like successful hunters that I've talked to or listened to on podcast or watched on YouTube is they're always asking that question. Why? Like, why was that buck there at that specific time? Was it the bedding? Was it the transition area? Were there hot does in the area? And why did I see him? Was the wind right? The wind must have been right. My thermals must have been right. There's so many different things that kind of has to go right for the most part if you want to consistently get on big bucks. And I think a lot of people, if you're just getting into hunting, or even if you've been hunting for a little while now, if you had those encounters, you really need to be asking yourself all those questions. Because it's going to make you a whole lot more successful, and it's going to shorten that time of, because you talked about there was a 4-year period where you got on basically 2 mature bucks in 4 years.
That's right. When I'm mature, I'm you know, this is going to be, for me, a mature buck is 4.5 or older.
Right.
It's what I consider a mature buck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Around this area.
Right. Yeah. And that's pretty good. I mean, obviously it varies from wherever you're at in the country. I mean, in the Midwest, somebody might say, oh, a 5.5-year-old's a mature buck. I think Texas, they say, oh, 6.5-year-old's a mature buck. And Florida, I mean, 3.5, 4.5, it doesn't really matter. It's just that those bucks have reached a certain age where they're kind of a different animal. They're not the first ones out. The feeding, they're not the ones walking in the wide open. It's definitely a different animal. So you've been hunting public land now, and I think you said this, for 13 years, right?
So yeah, I started when I was 19.
Okay.
I'll be 34 going into this next season. I'm 33 now. And there was a 2-year period. I would say 2014 season, 2015 season, that I totally got out of public, and I got into a private lease on my own,
right?
For 2 years, and both years I tagged out on bucks when I got off of public land. Both years I tagged completely out. From what I learned hunting public land, like when I went back to private, it was just seemed to be, you know, so much easier, and everything applied like even more there.
Right. And now, do you think that was
You think pressure played a big part in that as well?
Yeah, I would say pressure, and I think mainly, on private land, people do the same thing. And right. Yeah, I'll tell you what I keyed in on. When the first time I stepped foot out there, I asked the guy who was over it and showed me around. I said, I want you to show me every place that nobody hunts. I want you to take me somewhere where people don't hunt, because I know on private land, people have their little area that they hunt, and they will stick there most of the year. They'll take a little area, and they'll hunt it to death. And right. You know, I was like, show me out here, because he knew everybody. He knew where everybody hunted, you know, whatnot. I said, just show me the place that nobody hunts, and I'll hunt them. You know, I'll stay out of y'all's way. And that's where I killed all of them, all my best.
Now, did they kick you out?
No, they did not. But there was some other stuff that happened, and it was with turkey, because the way the land laid out, people would try to claim this whole, like, part of a lease. And I'm like, I just want to go over here to this side. They're like, well, if I hear a bird, I'm coming over there, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So, anyways, it was just some stuff like that. And I was like, you know what? I'm going back to public, because guess what? I can go anywhere I want on public. I can do whatever I want on public, you know, for the most part, within the law. Like, if I want to go walk an area, I can go walk it. If I want to go hunt somewhere else, I can go hunt it. I don't have somebody there saying, oh, you can't go over here. Oh, you can't go do this and that. You know, yeah, it may have been easier on leases, but the freedom that public gets, man, I don't think I'd ever give it up now. I just have that freedom to go and walk and hunt it pretty much how I want to within the law.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the great advantages of hunting public land. And pretty much you're not really – a lot of these pieces of public, I mean, they're pretty good size. So it's not like you're bound by a property line for the most part of a small – of a club. I mean, I don't know how big that club was. I mean, some of them range. Some of them are small. Some of them are thousands of acres. But a lot of times you kind of get caught. It's like, well, I think that buck's spending – 75% of his time on that other piece of private, and I can't get over there to hunt him, and I've just got to rely on the 25% of the time, where on public you might be able to be a little bit more tactical and figure out where the deer are. And your story of kind of about going in and tagging out on bucks for 2 years in a row, I had a good buddy of mine. He was telling me a story about a buddy of his that he got into this like big private lease. And everybody, same thing, everybody had like their condo stand or ladder stands that they had set up. And he went in there like his first year, took his climber in and was hunting mobile. And he killed the three biggest bucks on the property that year from just, he just got in between. He's like, he knew where the bedding was. He knew where they were going out to feed. He just set up in those transition areas and ended up killing the three biggest bucks on the property. And they ended up kicking him out of the lease that year. So
that didn't surprise me at all.
Yes.
You'd be surprised. People are so jealous of deer.
Oh yeah. Yep. Even I understand that. So 2014, 2015, you went back to private. You realized, okay, you don't want to really deal with the politics. And it kind of like verified what you were doing on the public, that you were able to get on the deer there.
Yeah. And it made me want to just go back and hunt public more. So for 2016, 2017, I was trying to hunt two WMAs. So this is really where they went really good, and they kind of went really bad for these 2 years. And it just lit a fire. I mean, Chase, it lit a fire under me. So 2016 and 17, I tried to hunt two WMAs. So I killed a few deer on one WMA. I went to the other WMA. I killed a few deer, a couple, you know, just smaller bucks, but I just wasn't having the success I thought I should. And I was like, I felt like I was too strung out between the two.
Right.
And it was at that time I told myself, in between 17 and 2018, I was like, you know, I've hunted this other WMA for all these years. I know so much about it, and it seemed like if I ever stuck it out for a whole year, you know, I didn't kill a big buck every year off of it, but I usually always had an opportunity at a 3.5 or older buck every single year, probably after year four. I had some type of opportunity, whether, you know, they smelled me, whether, you know, they caught me off guard or I couldn't get a shot, or, you know, just something. You know how bucks will do you.
Oh, yeah.
And I told myself, I was like, I need to just stick to this one WMA. I feel like I'd have more success doing this. So really going into 2018 season, that was my plan. I was going to stick to this one WMA, the one that I've had the most experience with, and the same land I started off hunting. And I started hunting it, and I really picked out mainly one really big chunk of this WMA. And I started hunting it. I killed during this time of 2015, 16, 17, and 18. Then four seasons in a row on opening day of bow season, I killed a deer on opening day, all 4 years in a row on the WMA that I told myself I was going to stick with. So, anyways, going in 2018, opening day, I killed a deer, you know, continued. That was 4 years in a row I killed a deer in nearby in the same area. And I started thinking to myself I kind of understood these deer in this area because I was always getting on them early season and I would leave them alone. I wouldn't go back any more that year. I'd go kill one deer in this area and I'd leave it alone. So I was like, I started expanding in that area and started really just scouting it during season and popping into places hunting it, and started really figuring out some deer in this area and seeing a lot of deer. And it was in that same time I started getting into podcasting, right after the end of 2018. And I was listening to podcasts and listening to guys. I knew nothing about it. And at this time also, I forget to mention that going in 2018, I made a promise to myself that I was going to do whatever it took to be the best deer hunter that I could be, you know, going into these next few years. You know, I was going to do anything I could. So when I found the podcast and they were talking about how much scouting is what I heard, and then postseason scouting, a lot of people started talking about it because that was about the time deer season went out. So for the first time ever, I went postseason scouting, and I walked every single trail in this area that I seen a deer on and followed them. And you talking about learning something on a piece of land when you walk every deer trail that you can, and mainly, I mean, trails that you see deer on, and you start to understand their the way they're traveling through a piece of land. You're understanding, okay, I know this is food and this is where I'm seeing them. So when you start backtracking, when you start understanding where they're bedding at, and then you find them areas in between them beds that's just loaded with deer sign. And that seemed to be the places going into the future. I was like, hey, I got to hunt this. I would pick out a place to hunt them areas when I was in them during postseason, because when season rolled back around and it got back into that time frame, a lot of the land was going to look the same. You know, that's, to me, postseason scouting was a giant key to my success. And some of these areas I went back in are the areas I started killing the really nice bucks in, right off the edge of bedding, in these little transition spots where you had a transition line, but it was also a transition from just off of bedding way before they get to the food. And it was always seemed to be in thick cover. So I started learning all this as postseason scout. And I also were using a few trail cameras that first year in 18. And then I started putting them out postseason scouting. And I started finding deer, and I would try to put them all up and down these trails and figure out how they were using this trail. And that ended up going into how trying to figure out how these deer use this whole area. And it was at that time also, I heard a guest on a different podcast, and he talked about how what led to most of his success early on was he picked out just like, a square mile in public. And he said, you learn everything you can about that square mile. You learn every deer, every doe group. You learn what deer live there, just every single thing, like kind of like if the U.S. Army was going on a mission, you know, overseas somewhere, you're going to figure out every single thing you can about the enemy before you get there. And I was like, that really hit home with me. I was like, that's kind of what I'm doing now and what I told myself. And it just really hit home, and I dove deep into it. I started trying to track deer using my cameras and using postseason scouting. I started seeing when the fawns were born. I was like, you know, you go back around 7 months or so. I'm like, wow, this is when they're rutting in this area. I didn't realize that. I could have swore everybody has always told me it was around this time of the year is when deer went in the rut here. And that's not what I was finding. So that really intrigued me. And it just lit that fire even more. And it's just crazy what I know about this area now. Like, I can tell you, like groups of those that use certain area, I know within a week or so period of when they're going to come into estrus. I know now about what time these mature bucks are going to start hitting these areas. I know now how these mature bucks like to use this area during rut to check all the doe bed areas. What is that trail they want to walk? And once I started figuring that out, it changed the game for sure. Just absolutely learning everything I could. And it was by walking trails, postseason scouting when the leaves were still off, and then using cameras even in the season when I find a really nice buck I'd like to kill, I would scatter cameras down the trails and try to figure out where he was coming from or going, and just trying to figure out what I could about him and just really putting pieces to the puzzle. I use a hunt stand. And my hunt stand is littered with pins. I pulled it up earlier today, and it was just like a big blob. I have, from postseason scouting, I have everything that looks like a very defined trail. I have marked, and I have walked them out and seen where they went. And I'm like, wow, I've seen deer here tons of time. I didn't realize this is how they're possibly getting over there, and they're coming from this area. And I'm like, And I kind of look at it, and I start knowing where some of the bedding areas are. And I'm like, some of these trails are just seem to be cutting on the downwind side of the, you know, a lot of times we have some type of northerly wind. They seem to be cutting on the south side of a lot of these bedding areas. And I start figuring out what a buck trail looks like, basically. When you got all your main trails weren't running a certain way, it always seemed to be a really faint trail that either just V'd off of them or either crossed them in an angle or perpendicular with them. It would be the faintest trail. It almost looked like almost like a varmint trail or like a coyote trail or just something really light walked through there maybe one time. Just right. These real subtle little trails. And I started finding that was the buck trails. and put my cameras on them and just following them. I mean, man, I've learned so much since 2018 to 19 to 20 season, just by pure, just starting getting into podcasting, my work ethic. I've never put this much time into hunting, like scouting. Like, to me now, how I used to look at hunting, I would hunt maybe, hunting was 5 months of the year. As of right now, hunting for me is 365. As a matter of fact, this weekend, I will be out there this weekend now that turkey season's over.
Right.
I've just, you know, your work ethic will reflect a lot. I feel like the more time you put in it and all, you'll have more to show for, you know, in the coming years or in the near future.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I could definitely tell some of the years where I didn't put as much work in, like the results weren't there. Like I definitely didn't get the results that I was looking for. And the years, kind of like you're talking, making it a kind of a 365 type deal instead of it just being when hunting season's in, basically, or you maybe get out there a couple of weeks before the season or whatever, and you don't really do hardly anything after the season. But once, kind of like you're talking about, just really investing and using like a year-round approach, you have proven it that the results will come.
I feel like this year for me, you know, when season was coming close to an end, I think I was more excited that it was about to be time to start scouting again, postseason scouting. I don't know if I can explain how much I like postseason scouting. I just absolutely love it because I try my best whenever I do hunt to stay out of most bedding areas. I try not to interrupt them. I try to make the best access I can. I always look at my wind when I go hunting. It determines where I hunt 99% of the time. Wind determines where I hunt. So using that caution, so I look forward to postseason because I'm about to go head first in these bedding areas. I'm going to these trails that I've seen these mature bucks on, that I've seen these does on, and yeah, I may have walked them last year, but I'm going to walk them again. I'm going to see if anything's changed in there, if they change anything they're doing. I think in this area.
Okay.
I should have mapped it out earlier so I could really give you a good idea of how large or, you know, how small this area is, but I would at least say it's probably at least 400 acre square, maybe 500 acre. But I feel like I near about walk most every trail in this area already.
Yeah.
And doing so, I put a lot of pieces that I didn't have previously. I put a lot of pieces to the puzzle together already. You know, I said previously, I think I logged 52 hours since the end of deer season in Alabama, and was basically between the end of the season and the beginning of turkey season. I logged that. And for some reason this year, the deer seemed to lose their horns earlier than years past, because I have pictures of deer with their horns in late April, and this year I found some fresh sheds in towards the end of February, I think it was. And that really paid off because I had an area that I knew bucks come through. And then I had another area I knew bucks come through. But I wasn't sure how they were getting between the two areas, like exactly how they were traveling through this one section. So I really focused in on it and tried to figure out what I thought, but there was nothing there that I could really, that really told me exactly how they were traveling. Well, so this year, postseason scouting, I have a buck that in 2018, I ran across, I caught him on trail camera. I actually near about, well, pretty much patterned a deer that first year in 18. And I took a guy with me and we set up on this trail. I'm like, he's coming from your way first, or he's coming from my way first on this trail today, this morning. And sure enough, he come down that trail and the guy who went with me, and the deer ended up walking out 15 yards in front of him and made a scrape. And his deer's facing him. Now, he tried to climb a pine tree that was too big for his climber. So he couldn't, he only made it about 6 foot off the ground. And where the deer was, he was eye level with him because it slowly sloped off to where he was. So he's eye level with this deer, just frozen, can't do anything. And the deer starts walking down the trail and gets some cover between them, and he draws back and he's like following the deer, waiting to walk out to the next open. And when you're on a big tree that's too big, your stand kind of kicks up real high. And when he wasn't thinking about that, and he dinged his bow against that stand. That deer tore out of there. And he stopped between me and him. And I had actually climbed a tree that morning, and probably one of the first times, and actually hung a lock on. It was like right at the end of season. Hung a lock on this tree, and this deer ended up working behind me on high alert.
Right.
He comes down this trail, and I was like, wow, I might get a shot on him. And I get drawn back, and I have a limb that's interfering, where I just can't get my bow over this limb to get on him. Like, my bottom pin is touching the top of his back, but I can't get my 30-yard pin down on him. So that deer walks. Well, we ended up, my buddy ended up actually calling him, he called him Lucky. That's what he called him. He said, yeah, well, I'm going to call him Lucky because he better be lucky he didn't walk out in front of you, that he walked out in front of me. And this deer, the following year, I see the same deer, basically on the other side of the same bedding area. And this deer does what none of the other deer are doing in, you know, in this little spot. He makes a beeline right to me. And he's basically walking right to my tree and has some cover. And I tried to get a shot on and never could. And he got away from me that year. And I also had a chance at him this year. I think he's 5 and a half now. And anyways, I couldn't ever get a shot on him. He walked behind me. He did the opposite of what I was expecting again. This will be the third time I seen, three seasons I seen this deer. I had an opportunity that I couldn't, and I didn't kill him. But what I did notice is the deer seemed to be, for some reason, he seemed to be walking right with the wind slightly at his back most of the time I seen him, and he would walk like 5 foot and stop, and he would just look forever like a statue. And I mean, it was weird. It was almost like he got called out late rutting and trying to slip back into bedding area. But anyways, long story to get to this is I found his sheds this year. And it was in between two areas that I knew these bucks traveled. And I found one shed on part of this trail and ended up finding his other shed about 200 yards away on the same trail. And I ended up walking that trail, and it took me exactly to the spot I'm having encounters with these mature deer. And it basically put a big piece of the puzzle together of how these deer were getting between these two areas that I previously did not understand, and I needed to understand to help me get on these deer better. And so that's just one piece of the puzzle, which to me is a big piece of the puzzle I put together just postseason scouting right after season that I would never have known about had I not been out there postseason scouting. That could lead to me killing another buck this coming season.
That's true. Maybe it's the year that Lucky doesn't live up to his name. It sounds like he's been living up to his name for the last three seasons.
Yes. And this year he kind of lost. he lost a lot on his right side. His left side is still really big, but man, he's just a mature buck, and his body is bigger than any deer I ever seen on this public. He's just, I mean, he's easily over 200 pounds. Just big body, just big old fat belly.
Oh yeah. Well, let's talk about, I'm really interested in the targeting certain bucks on public land. I know a lot of people when they hunt public, they're not necessarily targeting a specific buck. They're getting in areas where they're going to see deer, basically. I mean, right. They're finding areas where, okay, I got a good chance of shooting a deer. Now, what, and it sounds like you're putting a lot of post-season scouting in that's helping you kind of target these mature bucks. Is there ever any worry for you about other hunters in that area, these bucks making it another year? And how many different bucks would you say that you're actually targeting during a season?
Well, I say it's always a worry on public land that somebody else may kill a deer. But that's just part of it. That's part of the excitement, and that's part of the challenge for me. And I would say, you know, I'd say year two, you know, I run a few trail cameras. Also, the past 3 years, I've run anywhere from around 6 to 8, not a ton of cameras, but, you know, enough to really help me out. You know, they do a lot of scouting for me. So the deer that I know about, there was, I'd say the second year, there was probably, I think it was 3 deer that I would really like to kill. And, you know, just kind of postseason scouting helps me expand my areas a little bit and understand better. So this past year, 2020, I think I had 5 different bucks that I was really kind of targeting. There's a couple of them I knew I wasn't in their home range, but I knew they did travel through these areas looking for does. Part of my goals for this off season is to find them 2 deer, because they're really, really good deer, and I want to see if I can find their home range and expand my zone a little bit now that I'm really understanding it and expanding out more. So I think this past year I was targeting around 5 different mature bucks, and I had an encounter with one, which was lucky, and then the one I ended up killing early on in January, he kind of showed up in early November, and I had a pretty good bit of pictures of this deer, and I was after him. He was running the same area that kind of that Lucky was running, so I was really after them two really hard. And there were days I kind of noticed like a somewhat of a pattern that these deer would be in a certain area. I mean a certain area, I mean like maybe a little 40-acre like section that there's a doe group that lives there, and they come in there and they find one of them in heat, or they're checking them. And there was a 2 to 3 day period and bucks would hang in that area before they moved on to the next one. And they seemed to be making like loops around to the bedding areas, and they'd make their way back to this bedding area anywhere between 8 to 12 days, it seemed like. So I kind of knew that. So whenever I did find, you know, check some of my cameras and found a picture, I would know, as I look, it's hot right now. It may, you know, if I can't get out there and hunt right now, I may need to try one of these other areas to catch him where I think he's swinging around to. Mm-hmm. And in so many days, I need to be back in his area and try to catch him there. And I played cat and mouse with him a little bit. And there was days that I missed him by maybe 1 day or maybe just like 12 hours. And I ended up connecting with him early in January and was able to harvest one of the deer I've been after targeting.
Yeah, I've kind of found that
down here when I started kind of putting the pieces of the puzzle together more, is kind of noticing a pattern like that, to where you kind of figured, okay, this is the area where the buck's at, but he doesn't stay there very long. He, like you mentioned, he might be there for a couple, you might catch him a couple of days on camera, and then he might disappear for 9 to 10 days, and then he'd show back up for a couple of days and then disappear again for 9 or 10 days. And I kind of played that same game this year with two different bucks. You know, one I ended up killing. The other one I had at 10 yards. It was just a property line that saved his life that day. And he ended up winded me, and he spooked off, came on the property, but I didn't have a shot on him. And I've actually been after that deer for 3 years. I wanted to get him more than anybody, because I had so much history with him, and finally trying to figure out, okay, this is that kind of missing piece of the puzzle, because I don't think he stays on the property. I think he beds between two different properties, and I can't get over to that other property to hunt him. Yeah, it sounds like you're putting together just a tons of, you've got all these pieces together, and you're getting them all together, where it's kind of in this area, like you mentioned, you're pretty much close to putting all the pieces of the puzzle together in this area, and you're deciding to transition out a little bit. Now, how far do you think you'll kind of transition out to? Are you just mainly you're kind of consumed by these couple of bucks, and you're just wanting to find their home range?
Well, yeah, yes and no. I am consumed by them, but I'm not, you know, losing focus on what I have. Mainly, just say on the edges of this, just say 400 square acres. I'm going to start on the edges, you know, and scout them. After I scout my core area, I'm going to hit these edges and start expanding out into them and looking for things that are a lot like what I find the mature bucks in now. And just really trying to go in there and figure out where I think these deer are. And I'm going to put some cameras in there off season. And basically my plan is to catch them in the horn growing season. Like I know exactly where Lucky's going to be when he's in velvet. He was hanging out with a 10 point that was 3.5 this year. I kind of, you know, it was like, you know, I'm not going to shoot this deer this year. And from 3.5 to 4.5, they make a giant jump. It is crazy. I almost like a different deer sometimes. And I'm really excited to see how big this 10 point is going to be next year. And him and Lucky, from day one, when I found them 3 years ago, they were together in velvet. The next year, they were together in velvet. And this past year, they were together in velvet. I know it's the same deer.
Right.
So I'm not losing focus on them. I know where they're going to be, but I want to try to find these other ones now that I have them pinned down. Does that make sense? Now yeah. I can go pin down more. So I'm not blowing out one area. I'm trying to hunt some of these areas when the time's right. And other sides of this bedding area, I'm going in and I'm hunting them with the wind in my favor to access them, so I'm not blowing these deer out or spooking them too much. So I'm not hunting the same area over and over. I do have places that I hunt several times, but I have really good access, and I always, not always, but most of the time the wind is good for my access. So I'm really going just go on the outskirts and try to find these deer. And I want to pin down. So, you know, I have them two deer pinned down. I got two more that I know their core area, but I don't know exactly where they are in velvet. I have plans of figuring that out and then expanding out just a little to try to find these other two and try to pin them down. Cause when you can pin down multiple ones, you got multiple deer you can hunt whenever. Just say one showing up more on camera, you know, this deer is going to be, my odds of killing this deer is going to be way higher than maybe going over here trying to kill Lucky, because he's right. Hardly showing up at all. So I'm going to go after this deer. I'm going to go after the deer that gives me the best opportunity. So the more deer I have, you know their areas, you know, just that's just hopefully the higher my success is going to be. And
yeah,
also using cameras, like if I know this deer is going to be in this area, I know he's just previously been in this area 2 days before. You know, most people are like, oh, this deer was just here, I'm going to camp out here. Well, I know because I hunt this area for the past 3 years and just spent all my time in it, that 2 days later, 4 days later, the deer's, that buck's not going to be in this area. He's making his loop. So I'm trying to figure out what that loop is for these mature bucks. And I have, I would say, a third of what I call this loop pinned down to exactly what trail they're walking. And that's actually where I killed the deer I was targeting. I killed him on that trail. And that's also two of the places that I was within 10 yards of Lucky as well. And I have several other mature bucks I walk this trail. So I figured out a third of it. I still have at least two thirds more to figure out, maybe more. And
oh, yeah.
So I have a lot of work to do. And then I also want to find these other deer. So, you know, I'm not overpressured in one spot and I can, you know, just go in there and try to hunt them from time to time where I'm not just camping out in one spot and blowing it out. Like,
yeah.
The trail I killed that buck on was my third time in. I'm not hunting it all year. I'm not hunting it early season. I'm not hunting it until these deer go in the rut and they start seeking those. That's when I'm going in and keying in on these areas. Before then, I'm going in hunting different places I've never been and learning what I can from through observation and just knowing that this is a good bedding area that deer are using. And I may find out something I didn't know.
Right.
And if I don't see anything or don't work out, I'll bounce, you know, 150, 200 yards down and try again, depending on the wind.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't take me too long to figure out about like blowing areas up, like going in and trying to aggressively get on these deer when the timing wasn't right. And once I figured out, hey, go hunt somewhere else. Like, go scout somewhere else. Go sit somewhere else. You know that traditionally the deer are going to be here around this time. There's no point in going in there and blowing up the doe groups that are in there and having them all on edge and everything else. So it's something that I think a lot of people kind of miss is just thinking that they found this juicy area and not hunting it when it's right.
Right. See, I love to, I may not hunt it, but my camera's going to be in that area. And right. We'll check it, you know, periodically, depending on what the wind is. If it's raining, I love it. I'm going to slip in there when it's raining. I'm going to check my camera. And right. My camera shows me, hey, these deer are making this transition. They're starting to walk this trail. I start getting prepared to hunt it, you know. So the camera is doing a lot of scouting for me. It's telling me what time of the year I should hunt. And I'm leaving these cameras in some of these areas, just say on that one third of the buck trail that I know that the bucks travel. I leave cameras on them nearby all year. I want to understand the deer in these areas, the does when they're coming into heat. So when I leave them out all year, I may not hunt some of these places, but I can go back in there at some point and check this camera. And there's a pattern of when this deer likes to be in this area. So I got 3 years of data, and I have data that shows maybe November 22nd, every year, this mature buck or multiple mature bucks are visiting this area within this week's time. So guess what? When November 22nd comes around, that's where I'm going to be. Because right. Over 3 years, that's where they're traditionally at. Because the doe groups are going into heat there. Or there's a doe that goes into heat there every year around the same time. So with me saying that as well, in this area that I'm making my own, I'm trying to learn everything I can, just selling out on this area. I do not kill does in these areas because these does are what I rely on. These does are what makes the bucks visit these spots at a certain time. Them does are the reason I had a pattern on what time of the year that the bucks are going to be there. So I have another part of a WMA that I will hunt if I want to kill does early season and stuff like that. But in these areas, I'm not killing does.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. They're the ones that are bringing the bucks into those areas.
That's right.
During that time. So, yeah, go explore somewhere else and find some does elsewhere. Did have a listener-submitted question for you. He's actually a member of our Patreon group, Mr. Craig Kroom. He had a question on, so you're selling out to this public land. You also like to go venture out to the Midwest and hunt in the Midwest. How has your hunting, where you're hunting at, how does that transition to where you go out to the Midwest?
Going out to the Midwest is very new. I've only been doing it for 2 years now, 2019 season and 2020 season. How it transitions from hunting in the South versus there, that's hard to say because it is totally different. Where I hunt up in the Midwest, it seems to be it's all ag land basically, and it's wide open. It is fairly flat, the public I'm hunting up there, and there's just ag fields. It seems like as far as you can see, with just wood lines, small wood lots, small sections of maybe cedars and a few, you know, spots of thick cover. So when you look at it, you know, when you're in the deep South, you know, Alabama, probably Georgia, probably definitely Florida, I know that for sure. Like everywhere you look, a deer could be bedded in this area. Up there, it's not like that. They just can't be bedded anywhere they want and not be, you know, somewhat protected. So finding bedding up there seems to be way more predictable. Sometimes you can't see it from a map because some of these fields change from year to year. That's part of where I have a luxury, you know, where I go. My brother lives in the area, so he can actually go out there and tell me, hey, this year so-and-so is, you know, planted in this, or, you know, they cut this, or, you know, they burned this or done whatever. So I kind of know going into it, you know, that my area is still the same or what food source is out there. I mean, basically what I find is hunting the Midwest is basically I'm looking for bedding area. I'm hunting the Midwest also. The 1st of November, probably the first 10 days of November. So it's full on rut in this area. So I'm looking for bedding areas is wherever the does are at, that's where the bucks are going to be. So we know the does are going to be in bedding areas. No matter where you go, deer in bedding areas. And food sources. So they got big ag fields, and like this past year, there was beans. And it just so happens, this place that I hunt, the main food source on this property butts up to the main bedding area. So I'm basically just hunting a hard transition on the bedding and feed both places deer want to be. So when you're in a place both that deer want to be, especially does, you're going to have cruising bucks and rut just visiting these areas very often. And man, deer act like deer in the Midwest. I mean, I think I averaged up in 2019 when I went out there and hunted. I want to say it was 8 or 9 days that I hunted. 2 days, I only hunted half a day because I had some other stuff to do. You know, visiting my brother a little bit while I was there and my nephew. So with that in mind, really only about 8 days of full hunting. And I averaged seeing 22 deer a day, and 40% of those were bucks.
Wow.
And I would say the other thing I found is when you get in these areas, you're hunting, but you're also in a spot you can see a long ways. So you can kind of sit back and see what the deer are doing. You know, you need some good optics, binoculars and stuff. And so you can sit there and say all the deer are funneling in and out of a certain part of a field or bedding area, and you can observe it. When you observe that, you move then. The deer are doing that right now. So either come in the afternoon or come the next morning, that's where you need to be. The deer using that area right then, that's where you need to go to right then. And here in the South, you can't do that. It's too thick. You can't see that far. So
right.
You almost feel like a way better hunter. I feel like a way better hunter when I go to the Midwest. It just seems to be a lot easier, especially when you're used to the South and the challenges we face.
Yeah.
You can go out there. You had the ability to see a long ways. You had the ability to see hard transitions on a map. You can pretty much pinpoint where bedding's going to be at for deer. You can drive out there. Sometimes you can't see things on a map that you can, you know, until you're out there, but you can see what the food sources are just because it's big ag. So it makes things a lot more simplified for sure.
Yeah, I can agree with all of that, having hunted out in the Midwest, and same thing with the deer encounters and maybe seeing more mature bucks. I know in some of those areas they don't have as many tags as we do down here in the South. So the deer can get a little bit bigger and older up there. But yeah, everything you kind of mentioned, hit it on the head, is there's not a whole lot of bedding there. And there is a lot of food, but if you can find that area where they're wanting to bed and be able to get in between the transition there between both of them, that eventually there's going to be bucks cruising through that area.
That's right.
So, well, you mentioned after the last podcast we did that you were on, and something that you kind of wanted to mention was something that you were going to change this season in your setup. So what's that going to be?
So for me, for one, is, well, really last year I started this transition after 2019 and going to the Midwest. I ended up shooting a really, really big buck. And I'm thinking I got somewhat poor penetration. Not exactly sure, tracked deer from a long way. So the next year, this past season, 2020, I went with basically a higher FOC setup. I just dabbled in it. I just went up approximately 100 grains. And this coming season, I'm going to go a little bit more. I want to get to that 19% or so FOC. So I'm changing my arrow setup because I pretty much strictly hunt with my bow on public land. I'm a bow hunting guy. It's what I love to do. I probably hadn't fired my rifle in many, many years. So I'm going to be changing my arrow setup, kind of my broadhead setup and stuff like that. And then also I think I really need to mention this, that I didn't think about mentioning earlier. So the first year I started hunting this public land when I sold out, I think in 2018, I was hunting with my climber still. The second year in 18, I started, you know, that was my transition into podcasting as well. I started going mobile, but I just got into sticks and a lock on, and it really took a long time to get set up. I was like, man, it's so much easier with a climber, but I can hunt places I previously couldn't hunt in before. And it was at that time also somebody told me about a tethered event they were having. The closest one to me was Tallahassee, and old Parker's like, hey, these are some great guys. Go down there and check it out. You know, I was like, I've always thought about saddle hunting for 2 years. I was like, I don't know if that's for me. I don't know. You know, I feel like you stick out like a sore thumb. I feel like it'd be hard to shoot out of it, this and that. And so here I go down to Tallahassee, this past one y'all had, which I believe, was that your first one, Chase?
Yeah, the first one. Yeah, that was the first one we did.
So I go down there, and fortunate for me, Chase is the one who showed me, you know, the saddle and kind of told me all kinds of stuff about it and gave me all his luck for the season, which I didn't realize at the time that I do now. But anyway, so I was like, I brought my bow, shot my bow out of it, and I was like, I think I might like this. You know, I'm going to give it a try. All these, you know, these guys, you know, YouTuber guys and other podcasters, they're diehard hunter like I am, and they were saying that they can't believe they didn't get into it sooner. And I didn't realize how true that was until my first full season of saddle hunting, which was 2020 season, my past season, where I was able to kill three great bucks. I killed five deer total, two does. I mean, the first set I said I shot a deer out of my saddle. But I get into it. It's so much easier to put up. I can hide better than what I thought. I can hunt trees that I've always wanted to hunt. And I'm not bound by what tree I can hunt. I can go hunt near about any tree I want to. Change, you know, from all the things I learned through just nailing down on this one WMA, this was the next big step that I took that just changed the game. I was, you know, oh so close for having a big year in 2019. And when I switched to that saddle, that just seemed to be what I needed just to push me over the edge. I was able to get on deer, hunt places I've never been able to hunt. And that was a huge, huge game changer for me, was saddle hunting. I mean, just honestly, I mean, that changed a lot, because the trees I'm hunting in now are totally different than what I used to hunt. I don't even think I hunt the same trees now.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I was probably, I'd been saddle hunting. I'd saddle hunted the season before that, before you came to the event. And I was the same way. I'd kind of knew about saddles, but was kind of like, I don't know if that's for me. And once I finally switched to this, especially for bow hunting, I mean, to me, it's just ideal. I mean, it is made for bow hunters for sure.
Yeah.
And just all the opportunities, like you mentioned, just finding, going into areas like, well, there's not a tree here that I can get my climber in, or it's going to be a real big hassle to get a lock on in this tree, and all of those things. And I think it definitely made a difference for me as well, is when switching over to the saddle and not really being limited and being able to be like, all right, I'm here, instead of being like, oh, well, I'm going to be 30 yards off the trail this way or 40. Now I'm only 15, 20 yards off the trail.
That's right.
I can definitely agree with the saddles.
And you can pick out the trees with better cover or shot opportunities. And it's crazy how good you can use that tree to hide from the deer, you know, as they're moving. And I've actually used the tree to help me get draw back, you know, just moving with them walking and using the tree as my cover to draw back on deer, which before I wouldn't have been able to do at all at close range.
No. And I think it helps. I mean, and if you're into self-filming or anything like that, I mean, I think it's really set up for that as well, too. And I know you're kind of thinking about getting into some filming here this year. You're going to get a camera arm and use your cell phone and things like that. But you're kind of like on the same wavelength as me, is camera or deer, we're choosing the deer 101 out of 100 times, you know. We're always going to be choosing the deer.
If the deer gives me an opportunity to put a camera there or does what I think he's going to do and I already have the camera there, that's great. But I'm not going to miss an opportunity to shoot a big deer, because you don't get them opportunities often.
Right.
And you have to work really hard for them.
Yep.
I mean, so that was also one of the things I was looking at changing. And the other thing was just some little simple stuff with my saddle setup. Was I was just going to switch to 8mm rope, so they fit down in my pouch on the side of my saddle a lot better. Because I had a little problem putting my ropes in this year. It always seemed to be more of a struggle. It seemed to take me too long to put my lineman's rope or something back up. And I feel like I'd be a lot easier putting the 8mm in there and just making my setup just a little more efficient.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, you've got a good system now. There was several things that I saw at the teach and train, because you brought your stuff, and I was like, man, I want to incorporate that. So I'm looking forward to kind of tinkering with my setup a little bit this year, and just making it to where I can get a little bit higher up in the tree, or some of the little bungee cords and things that you had on your saddle just made things easier on the setup.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to doing that this year. Well, man, I appreciate you coming on and talking with us. I feel like you hit a lot of points. Is there anything that you felt like you might have left out that you wanted to share with everybody?
Well, I feel like it's important for me to say, if you want your deer season to go a little better next year, start now. Go out and start scouting now. Now's the time to be out postseason scouting. You know, I know in Florida things are a lot greener down there. Things are pretty much green here, but I'm still going out scouting. I'm still figuring out everything I can. And the more time you spend in the woods, the better off you will be. The more you understand your area and the land that you're hunting, the better off you're going to be, the more success you're going to have. You have to put in the work. It's not easy, but you can do it, because I went from a guy who knew seemed like nothing when I started public land hunting, and starting around 19 or 20, 33 now. I guess I'm just saying that I'm proof that you can do it. If I can do it, I know other people out there can do it. And I just hope this helps other people just light a fire into them and do more scouting, especially right after seasoning. Maybe try to dig in a little deeper to the areas they hunt and try to learn all they can and just be the best hunter and woodsman you can be. I just hope everybody gets that out of this, and I just hope it helps somebody in some way.
I think you said it best, and I challenge everybody to get out there and scout, and whatever you do, get outside and enjoy the great outdoors.